Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever or whenever you are. This is the Lightning Podcast, where we discuss and debate the weekly meditations without necessarily reaching any conclusions. I'm your host, Cyrus Polysbon, and I'm joined today by Zohar Atkins, Stuart Alsop, Nicolas Sarian, and Anne Dudek. Welcome, everybody. And also, I'd like to start off before we begin the episode, guys, with a little message. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review. It'll help us reach a broader audience, and it'll also help us get more people into the WhatsApp groups. If you're already in on this, you know that we have a group for every author of every quote we get out every week, and it's filled with people who want to learn, and more people who listen, more people who tend to join. So that'd be great. Okay, on to the quote of the week from Fulcanelli. To obtain the first agent, one must go to the back part of the world, where you hear thunder rumbling, wind blowing, hail and rain falling. That's where you will find it if you search. Nicolas.
Yeah, I'm just going to give like a short stint on the context of this, because people read this and go, what is this first agent? Yeah. This quote comes from a book called The Mystery of the Cathedrals, which is right here, which was written by a guy called Fulcanelli, whose true existence is not well documented. Nobody knows if Fulcanelli actually wrote this, or if there was a Fulcanelli, or if his disciple who actually existed, who's a guy called Eugène Cancellier, who was a French alchemist, wrote the book. So basically, it's a book on alchemy, and the main theme of the book is it has all of this alchemical stuff going on, but the main point is that he goes to the Cathedral of Notre Dame de Paris, which burnt down a few years ago, and he does this. He explains how the bas reliefs of the cathedral actually have alchemical insignia in them. So it's like the alchemist's guide to Notre Dame de Paris. But to go back to the quote, this is what is the first agent of, let's say, an alchemical operation. Normally, alchemy is the process of transforming base matter into noble matter, or let's say base metals into nobler metals, so like lead into gold. So the first agent is normally a base agent. So the idea of having to go to that part of the world where there is hail and rain, it's because you have to go to the dark side, to the base side of the equation, in order if you want gold, you need lead first. And that's why in alchemy, we'll talk about this in extension, but all processes start with, what do you call it? Dissolution, putrefaction, like stuff that nobody wants to deal with. That's the first thing you have to do, because in order to the first process of purifying a metal is to dissolve it. You need to, let's say, get rid of all of the impurities. In order to do that, it's not a pleasurable, it's not walk in the park. That's the most difficult part of the whole process, in fact. That's why, not to get like too anecdotal on this, but there's a famous novel by a French writer, Marguerite Yourcenar, that's called The Abyss. The original name is Opus Nigrum, and Opus Nigrum is exactly that, because the novel is about a Belgian alchemist in the 16th century. And one of the interesting things is that the novel is called Opus Nigrum. It's just like the first part. It's like, and nobody talks about that. Yeah, if you want perfection, you have to suffer first.
So that first step, dissolution is in a personal sense, the crucible, is the trial. Basically,
there's a meditation on why we suffer, and there's three explanations given, and two of them focus on the more orthodox and classical view, which if you poll the audience, if they have a theology, they'll tell you people suffer as punishment is a huge explanation that people give. You did something wrong, so now you have to be in some way. This is the punitive view of suffering, the judgment view. But there's a third view, which is that people suffer because God loves you And only suffering can, this is to Nico's point, only suffering can complete you. And the metaphor that's given is that salt brings out the flavor in meat. So to the suffering actually elicits a character in a way that if you weren't challenged, you wouldn't. So I don't know if that makes the suffering better or worse, but they call it the sufferings of love as distinct from, let's say, the sufferings of punishment. And just as a footnote to that, there was a Hasidic rabbi who endured the Holocaust and actually died. He could have stayed, he could have left, but he decided to stay in his community and be with his people. And he wrote a bunch of stuff and buried his writings underground, and they were found after the Holocaust. And in some of his last sermons, he used this language of the sufferings of love. And he says, could it be that what we're going through right now is like the salt that's bringing out the flavor of the meat? And he says, no. If that's the case, then God oversalted us. I think that's the counterpoint as well, is that the putrefaction, which we'll get to Nico's explanation on that, and the dissolution, but up to a point, because you can also overdose, perhaps, and then instead of getting the gold, you just get a bigger mess than when you started.
I might add to that, that the funny thing about, normally in alchemy you have these books made out of plates of different images, and normally they detail the process of the alchemical process, no, from base matter to gold. And normally the first few plates are about, it's normally putrefaction, dissolution, calcination. And then you see the images, you see someone being burnt in a, being cooked in an oven in the alchemical term for amber is atanor, like it's the ancient form of oven. So you have someone being burnt inside. The funny thing is that to which extent someone can do alchemy today is go and talk to the Jungians about that or something like this. Go and talk to a psychologist about this, but nobody tells you how long each process, each part of the work lasts.
They never do, so, yeah.
Exactly, because like, you know, it's normally, well, there's dissolution, then comes, so like, first, you have the dark.
We'll break it down for us, Nico.
Yeah, so you have the black part. You have, there's three. Yeah, Nigredo is the first one, right? Then you have Albedo, no? And it's three or four. Albedo is like the middle part. It's when to put it through an image that I brought up in Chronicles. I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago. Alchemy has, beyond these three or four stages, there's two main ways. There's two main, call it, yeah, ways, roads to the work. A dry path and a wet path, no? And you need to do both in order for it to be like some sort of transmutation, because it's, again, it's the masculine and the feminine, right? It's the anima and the animus. The dry path is, sorry, the wet path is, imagine dew, moisture coming down onto earth. You're receiving something. There's something that is in a sense foreign to yourself. And that in this, and that's the dissolution, because you're having a liquid that is dissolving at the base matter. The dry path, that's the wet path. The dry path is when that liquid is evaporated, no? But you can only evaporate that liquid by heating up the solution. So it's these processes of humidifying, dehumidifying, humidifying, dehumidifying. The issue is that, okay, when does this end?
and translate that humidifying and dehumidifying applies to a life. Yeah.
Yeah. This is where it's like the most complicated. But what I would say is that when you feel something you do not like, and I say this like totally on a personal level, like my experience going through these things. When you feel that something is foreign, no, something that is not part of you, something that is alien or any form of alienation, that is dissolution. Because something appears, this can be even not just, let's say, as an interior psychological state. It can also be an existential state where you're in a situation where you don't want to be. And there is a, call it a dissociation that occurs between two parts, the part experiencing the situation and the context. So to put it these like in simpler terms, anytime you feel that there is something that is out of place or that does not belong to you, that's the beginning of the work. Because so, that's exactly where I'm trying to think of the word here. Yeah.
For example, let's say a young person has a worldview they grew up with, mm-hmm. and then suddenly they're confronted with the reality that it's not so. That's
a shattering. That's a dissolution. No.
Okay.
That doesn't mean that that the previous, let's say the established worldview that was before that is wrong. It means that it does not work anymore. So it breaks right. down.
It was a prior.
And then what's the heating up? What's yeah. the other one in that analogy?
Now, yeah. So that's the initial phase, no? The heating up
part two.
It's part two. That's, again, so you have the nigredo, which is the dissolution. And what I want to say is that, to me, alchemy has this kind of like gaslighting elements in it because, yeah, great, like you're going through a nigredo, no? Like you're going through a dissolution in your life or a putrefaction. And so, yeah, it is dissolution. So like you're doing well because you're on the first list. Okay, but when does this end? That's the...
So what comes after though? Let's say that it ends. So what's the heating up?
So... After calcination, which is the next stage. In that three division that I established initially, it's albedo.
Yeah. Can you walk us through it using Cyrus's example of, let's say, a person grows up with a worldview, then they go off to college and they're like, smoke a bong and all that. No, my parents were wrong. And then they graduate and they're like, oh, actually, I want to work at McKinsey. So map that dialectic onto...
I mean, to be honest, it's a very American.
Yeah. Tales all the time. Yeah. Bong and McKinsey.
I mean, first I want to see if like actually going to college is a dissolution or you know, it's not everybody goes through this. I think that's the point.
Let us create the steps for you. So let's say the worldview was changed. That was this person's disillusion. What's the next mm-hmm. step? And what does that look like for them?
So,
what is the what I would say is that
there is no, when you're in a dissolution, a real dissolution, you don't know what the next step is, no? And that's the whole point. And I mean, if there is next step, it's like
of a new worldview. Like, and then you go through another dissolution because that worldview has been calcified and it needs to dissolve when presented with new information. To your point, then you just go through this cyclical.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, my way of understanding this is that the bigger the nigredo, the bigger the dissolution, the bigger the next, the drier path. So, like, the outcome of it. So, the deeper you go, and sometimes you can only go so deep. There is not much more to, and it's not a conscious process. Like I don't believe that you can will dissolution into existence. Even if you do drugs, like.
Okay, but what about just not from the individual's perspective, but from the alchemist's perspective? If you're from the outside looking in and you're organizing every transformation through this lens, so just, I understand dissolution. I don't really understand the next step in terms of the life stage.
But the point being that...
No, so can you help me?
No, yeah. I'm trying to...
I don't know the next step, Nico.
So yeah, like we destroy, like we get this base matter and we like totally destroy it, no? And then why does it come back? When do the pieces come back together, no?
This reminds me of when I was a kid. I don't know if you guys did this, but me and my brother, we used to take tubes of toothpaste and also like little conditioners and shampoos that we get from hotels and mix them all together and try to like essentially do like alchemy in the bathroom, right? And make these pastes that were like just like whatever liquids we could get our hands on. And then you're like, wait, so what comes next? Something magical, right? Like we get gold and it's no, you actually just have. So maybe that's the reason why the analogy breaks down is because.
You get a spanking.
Arguably, alchemy, it's a beautiful idea. It's a kind of fantasy. But maybe we're still stuck in this middle stage. Like, how many of us actually do see the gold, so to say?
Right.
Yeah. I was thinking of it with paint colors. When you're, like, mixing paint colors as a kid, and you're like, I'm going to make a rainbow. And then you just end up with brown.
What I wanted to say is that there's a thing called the peacock's tail, and you see this in a lot of alchemical manuscripts. So normally the first stage in lead is brown. No, it's a kind of a pale, like lifeless thing. Is when you start breaking that apart, like how do you get brown? No, by mixing all of the colors. So you from that brown, when you break that apart, you get all of the colors, the rainbow. But you can only get that by breaking down, no?
When are we going to have the all brown flag as the next phase in the sort of pride?
The point movement. Is that not to go back to the brown. That's a lot of the rainbow. No, I don't want to. I just want the brown life. I prefer to have my brown, like mediocre life.
I've seen the leprechaun and his pot of gold is just a pot of brownies.
Guys, but we did alchemy.
Right. It's easier to take pills.
We did actually do alchemy, though, because we turned silicon into an intelligent agent, or so far intelligent agent. What do you guys think about that version of alchemy? Not as much as it pertains to suffering, but...
Jesus. I mean, like, you're talking about silicon chips, no?
Yeah, he's talking about chips.
Yeah, you... Microchip. Yeah.
Well, that's what everybody's trying to figure out right now.
That's a great way to skirt the question, Nico.
What do you mean?
Yeah. Define every word in the sentence.
So I don't actually know... I don't really know much about how... Like...
I still don't know alchemy.
What is the process for taking matter and turning it into GPU?
I don't know, but I do know that there's this company, ASML, which is the only person who can manage the complexity of the supply chain that leads to semiconductors. And it's this crazy Dutch company that nobody knows about unless you study semiconductors. And it's like crazy math, crazy electronic engineering with people in those suits that go inside laboratories that are totally protected from any sort of things. And it's a wild process. It's totally crazy, the what goes into them.
So I think your question would stand even without semiconductors to AI. I think if you take anything, any technological transformation, we as the end user largely just focus on how it solves our problem. We don't focus on, quote unquote, the first agent, which is to say the material substrate that enables this thing to become a problem solver. When I look at a crane, I don't think about the process that went into making that crane. I'm just like, oh, nice. That would be fun to operate. And so I do think it's like quite mysterious when you really focus on any tool and you think about where did this come from. And it's not even a modern problem. The ancients themselves deliberated on this. I don't know. I see Anne nodding her head, but one of the classical examples of this is how was the first pair of tongs invented? Because you need a pair of tongs to make a pair of tongs, or you couldn't just reach your hand into the fire and take out the first pair of tongs. So how did you form them? And there obviously is an answer to that, right? But isn't that another way of expressing this first agent problem? And in Pirkei Avot, which is an ancient Jewish text from the turn of the millennium, the sages say that 10 things were created at the beginning of time. One of them was the talking donkey that appears in the Bible, and one of them was the first pair of tongs. So the point being that like these things are so profound that they actually had to be created by God sui generis, let's say God automated the creation process, but then there were 10 things that couldn't be, that the clockmaker couldn't just hit the button and automate. And one of them was the first pair of tongs. And I think if you think of that as a metaphor for technology more generally, it gets to this alchemical problem that we so enjoy these tools and yet actually have no idea how they're made. How many people know how to make a car or a car engine, for example? That's also alchemy, right?
Mm-hmm.
An airplane? A credit card?
Yeah. Computer chips.
And the AI people don't know what's going on inside of AI. This is a big thing that I've learned over the past couple weeks, is that they don't have what's called mechanistic interpretability. So they don't know what the individual neurons are doing in the neural network.
Okay, can I interject something there? Because I think this is not news, at least with another, let's say, quote, agent in the world. How do we know what animals are up to? It's a much more general example.
Dogs are looking at me.
Yeah, that's why we have biology and etiology and all of these things. No, we try and understand what the hell they're doing.
Yeah, I don't need to know. I don't need to know what the cheetah is thinking, though, to know that I should run away.
So
I think that's where pragmatism comes in, is that ultimately trying to understand the first principles of something may just be a category error. And the more interesting question is why you would try to understand the neural network of the cheetah as opposed to just like saying knowledge of the cheetah means knowing to get the heck out of there.
There's, I don't want to bring another quote into the discussion, but there's a famous line by Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, in the Pali Canon that says, when a house is burning down, you don't stay in the house and say, oh, is the fire real or not? What's going on with the fire? You just leave the house, no? And that's an analogy for what the Buddha thinks about what, let's say, to call it philosophy should do. It's like philosophy is not there, or like thinking is not there to ponder the existence or the ontology of the fire, but it's there to get you out of the house. So
maybe an alchemist is somebody, again, reading this term very broadly, who risks her life to understand if the fire is real and is willing to burn down to go down with the flames in an effort to understand what a flame is. There's another beautiful poem by Adrian Rich on Marie Curie, who discovered radium and died of radiation poisoning from exposure. I believe she won a Nobel. Poem's called Power. Mm-hmm. The last lines are, she died a famous woman, denying her wounds came from the same source as her power. I think there's a kind of masochism, to use your word, Nico, to scientific discovery. And we see that dramatized throughout the ages, even going back to Prometheus, who steals fire from the gods, or Pandora's box. Beware of trying to understand these things, because maybe that understanding is lethal in some way.
Sometimes you only get the truth by lacerating yourself, no?
But that's the dissolution, right? And then I think it's all a matter of a degree. But I don't want to do alchemy unless there's a safe word, personally.
Totally. It's like, why did we invent torture? Because we wanted to get the truth out of people.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Step two of the process. After dissolution, what comes next? Tell me. I have no idea.
I don't know.
I'm an alchemist.
I'm still dissolution.
I'm doing alchemy. I've dissolved my lead. It's now corroding into the floor. I hope it stops soon. What should I be looking for? What's part two? What's the albedo?
I'm trying to think of Yoda, Star Wars here. What would Yoda say?
Dissolve the lead, you must.
This joke, this is for Stuart. The next Bitcoin can only have started as a shitcoin.
PG-13?
Yeah,
PG-13. That was PG-13.
You're allowed one swear word. I'm sorry, I got this super vivid imagery of this new game. Instead of trying to pin the tail on the donkey, you try and pin the philosopher to a point. And is it possible? It's like getting Nico to answer what is the second stage of alchemy. It's not going to happen.
I know. It's like Schrodinger's.
Yes.
Okay, Nico.
Of course, there is a second. There is like second process. There is a second stage.
It's just only for philosophers too.
No, the most interesting part is the beginning. The rest. Who wants to talk about like happy days?
Then we'll return to the dissolution. Let's just get through the stages, because it's a quote about alchemy, and I know nothing about it, at least, and I'm assuming many audience members don't know anything about it. Let's understand the whole process before we focus on the of the first.
So once you break down things, no, again, like to use the image of the peacock's tail, no, you get this brown color that gets broken down. And at one point, you will see all of the colors, and that's where the rearrangement occurs, and that's what leads. So if you break down lead, no, I've never produced gold, but these guys have, and I'm not joking. People think of alchemy as in. Mostly today, you might have a Jungian, like a Carl Jung approach to alchemy, which is alchemy at the end of the day. There was these guys back in the day that were like fooling around with metals, but really what they were doing was the internal work. No, they were trying to perfect themselves. It was like all of the images were psychological. No, it's the symbols and all of that. But there are guys like Cancellier, who was his disciple. He made gold. Like, it's not a joke. Like, the dude had labs in Paris.
And the medieval alchemists were shape rotators, and the Jungian alchemists are word cells.
He's talking Twitter speak.
Stuart knows what I'm talking about. Just look it up. shape okay. rotators and word salads. It's mathematical nerds versus
people thinking images
versus verbal nerds.
Rotating shapes in your heads.
There's a famous meme of a man and a woman in bed, and the man's looking away, and the woman's trying to understand what is he thinking about, and. And in one of them, he's...
I bet he's thinking about other women, and it's just like something, yeah. But continue,
to, like, to go back to the point, so like after Nigredo, you have Albedo. So there's blackening, then there's whitening, which is Albedo. And the last stage is Rubedo, which is the reddening, in a sense. And yeah, it's difficult to understand how this works. The easiest... comparison or analogy, or not, it's not an analogy, I think it's something that you find in another tradition that works, is what you find in the Indian context. So like in, especially in the Vedic context, there's these three pulsions that you find in life, as tamas and sattva, no? And tamas is black, rajas is red, and sattva is white, no? And tamas, darkness, rajas, sattva is light, because it's what brings together both of them. It's like the feminine, the masculine, and the combination. The interesting thing is that in alchemy, the way it works is you have black, white, and red, no? Black and red are, let's say, the two polar opposites, and you have white in the middle. And in the Indian, the Vedic context, what brings together, let's say, the negative pulsion, which is tamas, which would be the nigredo, no? And rajas, which is the positive masculine pulsion, no, together, is sattva. So they're intertwined by light, in a sense. And this you find in the Vedic context. It's a, let's say this would be a chronical understanding of the thing, and not a diachronical understanding of the whole thing. Which what do I mean by this? Is that alchemy, who knows if alchemy is a straightforward process, like you go from one stage to the next. Or it's all of it is happening at the same time, so, all of the time.
So for the listeners, the diachronic would be the sequential, mm-hmm. and the synchronic would be the one in which all the time phases are actually happening at the same time.
Exactly.
So we think about it spatially as one after the next, but that's incorrect. That's just because our brains are too limited. Yeah. Synchronically, they say in the scripture as well. You can read it diachronically, like Exodus happens after Genesis, but you can read it synchronically, that both stories are the same story, and it's just different ways of looking at the same
story. So what were these alchemists trying to do? Yeah, they were trying to take hard metals. It was specifically about metals. What were they trying to do in this process besides create gold?
That was it, right?
I think that's part of the mystery of alchemy is that like all of the esoteric aspects of it, it's either because they were just like doodling and people say, okay, this is cool. Or there was some sort of encrypted message there that either stayed encrypted or only a few people, because the people that I know, like that know about alchemy or know about symbols, like normally what I get is, no, it's supposed to be like that. It's supposed to be a mystery. Otherwise, it wouldn't be alchemy. But I think actually the word alchemia comes from the Arabic, because there's alchemy in all contexts. But one thing I did want to say that you made me think about this when I was talking about like the sequential versus the parallel process of, is that in some alchemical manuscripts, you read this thing that alchemy is already happening in the world, whether you're an alchemist or not. Like matter is being dissolved and transformed all of the time. And you end up just participating in it, because digestion is an alchemy, no? Our body transforms. Mm-hmm. We eat something and our body breaks it down into nutrients and to a bunch of things, and we end up to that part of the world where you get the thunder and the rain, and that comes after.
I think of alchemy as a hinge. I think of alchemy historically as a hinge between the pre-scientific worldview and the scientific worldview. And so it has this kind of ambiguous status, because you can read it as magic in a way, mm-hmm. and therefore in some sense in a kind of anti-scientific posture. We can talk about that in a second, but you can also read it as like investigative and making something happen and kind of artifice, which is obviously a precursor to the science lab. And in fact, many of the early modern scientists were alchemists, or certainly friends with alchemists. So the line between the two. It historically, it was much fuzzier. But it all comes down to this. So Aristotle versus Francis Bacon. Aristotle believed, he was one of the first scientists, in the inductive method, in contrast to Plato, who believed in the deductive method. So for Plato, what you need to know are true things, and then you look out for case studies or examples to prove what you already know. But ultimately, the soul already knows everything, and all knowledge is just recollecting what you already know. And so there's no real insight that can happen. Nothing in your world can happen that will shatter your worldview or teach you anything. There's no empiricism. It's just, you already know what justice is, so now just go out and look for examples of injustice, and you'll, from the fact that you feel outraged by it, that will teach you what you already know about justice, that kind of thing. And for Aristotle, he would walk around and take samples from nature and just create bottoms-up taxonomies. Actually, this relates to your work, Stuart, with knowledge management. And essentially, you don't know what you don't know, but you can go out and look with your eyes and use your senses to gain more knowledge the more data points you have and begin to see patterns. But even though Aristotle was a scientist and for 1,000+ years, the most important one in the history of the West, his method is relatively passive because the samples that you're taking are all given to you, meaning like the best you can hope for is to go see like a rare wild animal or a rare plant, but it's still ultimately going into nature and just like looking at what nature gives you. And then with Francis Bacon, it's no longer about just taking samples. It becomes about manipulation. So you're trying to actually put things in new contexts that aren't natural, that only a human being could concoct, and see how they react. So if you think about, like, for example, modern scientific research, testing drugs on mice, that's not something Aristotle would have thought to do. Like, Aristotle would just watch the mice play, but the idea of what happens if I give a mouse like a ton of cocaine, that's not something that Aristotle. And so the alchemists, I think, are in between these two paradigms, because in some ways what they're doing is simply trying to observe nature. And the contrarian thesis is maybe nature's doing a lot of really amazing stuff, but we don't know how to look. So it's a practice of attention and trying to be in harmony with nature. And so these metals really do exist. They're naturally found. Lead and gold are naturally found. At the same time, the idea that you are changing lead into gold, because we were talking about alchemy is happening all around you, digestion. So digestion, that's natural. But you're also trying to make something happen that is arguably artificial in some ways. And so that's the rub, is when you successfully deploy an alchemical process, is what you're doing in harmony with nature, and that's what you're doing, and that's proof of your success, is that you found a kind of oneness with the laws of nature? Or are you in some ways like applying a kind of unnatural, if you will, pressure? And I know the words are failing me a little bit, to nature. And in Francis Bacon's language, he said some pretty severe disruptive things, that the task of the scientist is to, quote unquote, put nature on the rack, to torture nature for her secrets and that kind of thing. But maybe that's where alchemy ends up going, and it stops being this sort of esoteric practice, and it becomes the scientific method, which is just the practice of, if you can repeat the study and get a predictable response each time, then you can codify those laws. But those aren't the laws of theoretical nature, those are the laws of practical nature. So meaning, if I can only do certain things in the laboratory, then that's very different than if they're actually found outside of the laboratory. So I hope that was somewhat helpful. And I think that's, in terms of psychology, also probably a distinction between people that see their lives as kinds of scientific experiments and want to run that scientific experiment versus this idea that there are just certain things that make a life good, which would be the Aristotelian posture, and you're just largely trying to conform to that.
Is that why the rationalists and the scientists usually hate Neoplatonism? Because it stands in like direct opposition of what you just described of the scientific method from Francis Bacon, who's just going around and putting nature into a torture rack and such?
There was a lot in what you said, so I can't give a 1-minute answer to it. But the Neoplatonists are distinct from Plato. The Neoplatonist view is that everything is one, but there are gradations of truth that you can find. So essentially, as you move outward from the source, things become more diluted. Like God is, let's say, a core of absolute truth, but then maybe angels are like power godly and 20% base, and then you just move outward, and the further you get from the source, the less godly it is, but it's still ultimately drawing its energy from the one true source. So that's the kind of Platonic idea. But it's not really, Neoplatonism isn't really about knowing so much as it is like living, and that you're just supposed to live with this awareness that we're all one and we all emanate. And I think that is in tension with rationalism in a lot of ways, but one of which is that rationalism is trying to know things and make distinctions. And then empiricism is its own beast, but largely empiricism is focused on running experiments and using the senses to gain knowledge. Whereas if you, anything that's in the Platonic lineage doesn't really ascribe much value to the senses. Like at best, the senses confirm what you know, but they don't add to your knowledge.
Actually, like because it's easy to put Plato on that box, no? Saying that all aesthetics, the senses, like you do not get to the truth through the senses, no? But at least my reading of, let's say, Plato in the Symposium, like when, because Plato establishes a ladder, if you will, of knowledge and of love also, because love is tied to knowledge for Plato in an interesting way. Okay. And I think my reading of Plato hinges on this kind of alchemical quote we use today, which is that you cannot, yes, there is a high point, no? There is the perfection of knowledge or whatever, or of love. But you need the body first. You need to start with one body. You need the senses first. So, yeah, I think it's a gradation for me. It's a process of going from the lower to the higher. And what I was going to say also is that when Zohar was talking about the origins of, call it, experimentation in alchemy, chemistry came from alchemy. So, yeah, it's... 17th century, those centuries were very weird.
Me and Nico were actually talking on the Fulcanelli group.
Oh, right.
And he was just sharing material about Eugene Cancier. Is that how you say his name?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Did you see Cyrus.
He sent the long video.
Yeah,
documentary. And this is what these groups are great for. People have such knowledge and resources at their disposal, and they just share them with you. You never would have found them on your own. But we were talking about it, and it turns out this guy did turn lead into gold. Like, he actually did it. And so I said, oh, so the alchemist's quest is complete. It was like the surface level purpose. And he's like, what do you mean surface? Nico said, what do you mean by that? I said, they turned the lead into the gold.
Physically turned lead into gold?
Yeah, they literally did.
In what year did this occur?
To the Fulcanelli group.
Go to the Fulcanelli group and find out.
Scientifically, that's a matter of subparticles.
So I said, so alchemy's done then. It's finished. Like, that's it. And yep. But no, the idea is that it's the process of trying to create the lead into the gold, and it's the art of it that is also in and of itself an alchemical process for the person in the same way. And I said, right. So it's in the same way like a yoga master or a Tai Chi instructor or a samurai going through the sword movements is finding a higher purpose. And yeah. Nico said, yeah, perhaps. But also at the end of the day, the samurai does become a master swordsman.
There's that phenomenon in therapy where when you're reaching for the door, that's when you say the thing that the therapist wishes you could spend the session on. So I do have to go at 9:58, and I hate to drop truth bombs and run, but I also love it. So I'm just going to leave a provocation and then actually go, which is Brian Johnson is the contemporary alchemist. This guy does experiments on his own body. He shocked his pee-pee. And claims that he's like reversed aging in all kinds of ways. And he's done blood transfusions from his own son and posts photos and videos of himself doing these experiments. But it's not ultimately about the gold. It's about living forever. We didn't talk about immortality and that whole thing. But that also pairs with our discussion on Frankenstein from about a month ago. So I will leave you to think about that and also the potential neurosis or insecurity at the heart of the Alchemist Project, which is like, why not just seek a balanced, normal life? Why you got to go through all this crazy commotion to turn lead into gold? Just go get some normal gold. All right. Have a good week.
All right, guys. Thanks for joining us, everyone.